years later, when I was going through some tough times, he said, don't aim to have your best performance every day. Just aim to beat your average, because you will consistently improve.
My name is Jake Thompson, your Chief Encouragement Officer, and this is the Compete Every Day Podcast, a show designed to encourage and equip you with the tools to build a winning mindset so you can build your winning life. Text podcast to 972-945-9113 to join our Morning Motivation Club, and visit CompeteEveryday.com for past podcast episodes and to learn more about our resources and gear for ambitious people who are ready to start winning. Welcome to the show. Good morning, competitor. It's Jake, your Chief Encouragement Officer, and I'm excited to welcome you to this episode of the Compete Every Day Podcast. You are in for a treat as we have one of the best U.S. Olympians of all time, one of the best rowers of all time. In fact, Karin Davies just won the Thomas Keller Medal, which is awarded as a Lifetime Achievement Award in rowing. And guess what? She was the first American to do it. She has three Olympic medals, two gold, one silver. She has multiple golds at World Rowing Championships, World Rowing Cup. She sits down today. Oh, by the way, before I tell you about today's conversation, I forgot to include that she also has a psychology degree from Harvard, a doctor of law from Columbia Law School, and an MBA from Oxford. If you think you're a high achiever, Karin changes that conversation a little bit. But that's kind of the conversation that we have today about high performance. And what we talk about is, how does she deal with non-high performers in her workplace? How did she, from a competitive standpoint while rowing and now in general life, embrace gratitude versus fear of failure? She even takes a second to call me out on one of our Compete Everyday shirts, where we have a conversation on the real meaning behind it and why that meaning is so important. And you'll be surprised, she came around on our side once we broke down what we meant by it. But it was an insightful conversation. Karin is a ton of fun. She brings a ton of energy to what she does, and she has had an incredible career as a high performer in sports and obviously in her education and now in life, running a practice in the Boston area. And so you are in for quite a treat with today's conversation. As we jump into the show, I want to encourage you, if you get a moment, head on over to CompeteEveryday.com and support the podcast. If you haven't been over there this month, we just dropped a couple of shirts. They may look familiar, but have a fresh facelift. Similar to the April shirt of the month, Make Life Count, we have some designs and slogans that are near and dear to our heart, and we wanted to bring a couple of them back with a fresh look. The first is the manifesto. If you've been with us since the OG days, I think the first manifesto came out in 2013. You'll see we have a new look to it, a new style with some new phrases that very much fit what it means to have a competitive mindset. What it means to have a healthy competitive mindset, I should say, and to show up and compete every day for your goals. So you'll see the new manifesto at the link in the show notes. But secondarily, if you remember the episode that we did last month, really at the end of March, actually, with Mike Bednarz, the story of Mike falling off the roof and his road to recovery. And during the intro, I shared a story about how another member of Competitor Nation had reached out about a specific shirt on a day he was contemplating suicide. And I had a number of you email me, send me DMs on Instagram, ask about that shirt. Do we still have that shirt? And we hadn't. We had phased it out a couple of years ago. Rogue Fitness that retails us had phased it out. And we decided, I think it should come back. I think this is the time to come back and bring the Strong Sailor shirt, which the back has a giant anchor and says, stronger than any storm that tried to break me, and the reminder that a skilled sailor was never built from smooth seas. So if you're still standing, still competing, still chasing down your goals every day, no matter what life has thrown at you, head on over and check out this new release, which features a brand new colorway. It's red. It's got a beautiful light blue print to it. but it's got that same strong message for you of showing up competing through any storm, and that the easy road makes weak people, but the challenging one builds strong competitors. So if you want to support the show, consider grabbing one of those two shirts. And as always, as just being a loyal listener, you can get 15% off by using the code podcast at checkout. 15% off any order, whether that's shirts, flags, copies of both of my books, a new journal, you name it. Podcast will get you 15% off. It's an easy way for us just to say thank you for investing your time to hang out with me here on the show. Now, you didn't come here today to hear me talk. You came here to meet my new friend, U.S. Olympic legend, Karin Davies. Karin, welcome to the Compete Every Day podcast.
Thanks, Jake. Happy to be here.
So I have no idea what I'm walking into as the host of this, as we were just laughing off air, and I will happily give you some opportunity to have some fun with me. Before we do that, I want to get our guests introduced to you, because you have quite the athletic career, and oh my gosh, as if that just stopped there, professional career as well. You went to 3 Olympic Games, tried out for 4, right? And then just not content to say, you know, that was all I kind of want to do in life. You went into the legal world, which is really fascinating to me as well. And I've got some questions I want to pull at. But before we get into any of that, I heard you once talk about the idea of the boring. And we know the ability to embrace boring, especially from a sports perspective, is crucial to your success. Because I would imagine in your experience, getting on a rower and just rowing can get very boring, but it's integral to being successful. Talk to me about how you learn to love the boring and where it's shown up now in life after sport for you.
When I was younger, I had a quote pasted on my wall, and I've actually since learned where this quote came from, and I can't remember all of a sudden, but yeah, it's from a book. But the quote I had, it said author unknown, and it was a whole paragraph about how winning isn't normal. Have you heard this one?
No, but I 1,000% I'm already in. All right.
Winning isn't normal. Like, of all the people who compete, there can be only one winner, and forget all the people who didn't even bother showing up to compete. And in order to win, you have to train, essentially, and you have to be weird. You have to accept the loneliness and all the days of early morning training, because winning isn't normal. And I had that pasted above my bed so that when I woke up at 5:30 a.m., I could look at this thing and just be like, all right, I got to do what other people aren't willing to do. And in rowing, apart from the pain, in rowing, one of those things is just boring, boring training, just hours of literally just going back and forth and back and forth on a rowing machine or on the water. But being from the Northeast and having snowy winters, a lot of that was just on a rowing machine. And there are a couple of ways that I learned to deal with it. One is you play mind games with yourself. I did a lot of math on, like, how many minutes do I have left and how many strokes and counting strokes. You can try to distract yourself. Sometimes I watch movies. Sometimes I played podcasts. Hey, actually, when I first started running podcasts didn't exist. That's how long ago that was. but ultimately, like, you know, even with all these distractions and whatever, like, ultimately you just have to sit there. You just gotta do it. Like, there's no easy button.
There's not. Like, to your point, so many people never get into the arena. Then of those who do, only one wins. And that's a challenge for a lot of people. And I'm going to jump to a spot I probably wasn't planning to go this early. But one of the things that I wanted to touch on a little bit with you that I found fascinating in the interviews I listened to preparing for today was the idea of identity. And for a lot of us, our identity is very tied up in what we do, whether we are a lawyer, whether we're a business owner, whether we are an athlete. For me, football, like, that was the world. And those chapters end, or things happen during those chapters that completely get us off our game. And as an Olympian, like, I'm always fascinated by y'all. And I say this because so much more of your life is dedicated to this one sport and this one opportunity that, like, less than 10 minutes a performance, less than a minute for a lot, you know, the track and field. And if your identity is so tied up in that, like, how do you handle the transition after? And I've heard you talk about this, about what's coming and your plan after Athens. And so I was curious if you'd take us into a little bit of your journey with just your identity as a high performer in a sport, but how that wasn't the only thing that defined you, because I found that really interesting as you talked, because in other Olympic athletes I've heard or I've interviewed, I can hear a little bit of the, you miss it in the voice. But not that you miss the competitive side, that you miss being the active Olympian.
Yeah.
Like, because of the identity piece versus that. And so talk to me a little bit about your journey, because I really just enjoyed hearing that from you. And I think it would be very valuable for our listeners who, similar, can get tied up in their identity of what they do so much.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really dangerous road to go down. And I've been down it, you know, I can only speak from a place of experience where, if what you do and what you're good at becomes your identity, then you are at risk of losing your identity if you're suddenly no longer good at it. And it's going to happen. You know, maybe you get injured, maybe you just have some bad days. Like, I remember days just like standing in the shower and crying because I had a bad day of training. The way I learned to deal with it was to make sure that I maintained other parts of my identity, because none of us is one dimensional. We all have other things in our lives. And remember, I talked about how you have to accept the risks and the loneliness because winning isn't normal. I guess I should add an asterisk to that, which is like, yeah, you have to, if you want to win, you have to pursue that goal single-mindedly and for your own mental health. And also, I think, for the sake of achieving the goal, you need to keep other things in your life. So I was always doing other extracurriculars. Like, I did ballroom dancing when I was in college.
Can I ask you a question on that? Because you're not a short individual, especially as a rower. You're what, 6'4"? Okay, so 6'4". Yeah. Were you the tallest person in that ballroom class?
Yes. I mean, including all the guys.
Yeah, I was about to say, because that's not typically something where I would think about it. I'm curious, did that experience, were you just like, I'm here to learn and do it? Or did it feel awkward as, this is an escape for me? Like, did you really look at dance as, hey, I need an escape from rowing? Or was it just like, I want to explore things I'm interested in, and that never even crossed your mind otherwise?
Both. I started it because I wanted to explore stuff I was interested in, and I just love to dance. I think it's such a rush. It's such a high for me. But it was also I was also very aware that this is something other than rowing, because one of the things I found, especially at the elite level, is some people will judge you for having other things in your life. Like, to some people, if you maintain these other interests outside of your main passion, that means you're not committed. So I've had teammates tell me, I don't think you're committed to rowing and to this team. And my answer was always, this is how I show my commitment, because I'm a better athlete. If I have these other things in my life, it makes me more mentally able to weather the ups and downs of training and make sure that I'm just improving over the long term. So yeah, I had that. I always, I had a whole education of undergrad, law school and business school while I was rowing. Just had a lot of other things in my life. And you alluded to Athens. you alluded to Athens. So one of my older teammates, So Athens, 2004, that was my first games. One of my older teammates, before we left for Athens, pulled me aside. I don't know why she chose me, but anyway, she pulled me aside and she said, no matter what happens, win or lose, you will be depressed when you come home. And you need to have a plan for what you're going to do about that. You need to have some structure to your life. And you see it happen time and time again. I mean, there are athletes who have won a gold medal at the Olympic or Paralympic Games and come home and committed suicide because they were
just
so lost.
Hang on just a second. Sorry.
She told me, no matter what happens in Athens, we win or we lose, when you come home, you will be depressed and you need to have a plan for how you're going to deal with that. And you see it happen time and again. I have teammates who've been depressed. I've heard of, not known personally, but heard of athletes who won a gold medal, came home and committed suicide because they were just so lost. And someone once said to me a few years ago, they said, if I were you, I would never have a bad day. I would just put on all my Olympic medals and I would stand in front of the mirror and I would look at myself and I'd be like, you're amazing. And it kind of made me sad when they said that because I was like, I wish it worked that way. And there was probably a time when I thought it did, but I would say the high of achieving your goal of winning an Olympic gold medal lasts 2 weeks.
And then you return to baseline.
You're the same person you always were with the same fears and insecurities. So you better figure out who you are and how you feel about yourself without that goal, because that goal is not going to fix how you feel about yourself.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things you said there that one, from a timing perspective, we just interviewed a guy, a friend who's now become a friend, who they run a coaching program for practice and legal practice owners. And they're heavily committed to the idea of a great practice and a great life, because he himself was like, I was the guy grinding every day. When I get to 60 or 65, I'll enjoy life. I'll enjoy everything. And somewhere along the way, he got very fortunate to where he's like, I'm not going to have the family with me. And the quote unquote feeling of success is going to be gone in an instant. It's going to be like 2 weeks, I'm going to be back to baseline. And then I'm going to realize, oh, I wasted all of those years doing that, not enjoying that process. And I miss out on it. And so it's really cool to hear you say that from 2 weeks, you've returned to baseline and you've won multiple. The other thing I'm curious about is you talked about the teammate pulling you aside. And there's two things I want to go with this. The first is they prepared you mentally for what was ahead, whether it truly stuck at that moment or it was kind of a seed planted. I found that really interesting the first time I heard you tell that story, almost probably similar to what you have going into that workout. When you got to sit on a rower for an hour and a half and you just know it's going to suck, and the first 1,000 meters are going to be the worst, whatever it is. I always tell myself the first mile running sucks. It's the worst. You mentally prepared differently for it. Of like, you understand it's going to be a challenge. I'm just going to do the challenge. Did you ever go into at any point, and maybe this was your very first race never, to where you got caught off guard by that and then mentally made the adjustment that I know there's going to be pain and discomfort and it's going to suck, but I'm still going to do it?
Oh, yeah. I have such a good example of this. So there's this indoor rowing competition. It's called CrashBees. It stands for Charles River All-Star Has-Beens. But at one point, it was the World Indoor Rowing Championships. And they would have you do two 2Ks. And for everyone who doesn't know, a 2K is like 6 minutes of just like soul-crushing pain. Two 2Ks in a day, a heat. And then if you do well in the heat, you compete in the final. And I was in college. This was shortly after my first Olympic Games. And I think it was the first time I'd done two in a day. So I thought, okay, well, I'm pretty fast. In order to get into the final, I only have to do like not even close to what I'm capable of doing. So like, it's going to be easy. No problem. I just have to pull this number and I'll get into the final. So I went into that competition thinking like, all right, you know, the beginning's going to be easy. Big mistake. That was one of the most painful pieces, 6 minutes of my life. And I pulled exactly what I planned on pulling, but halfway through, I was calling on the ancestors, you know, like, I don't know if I'm going to make it through this, because I hadn't prepared myself mentally. That pain, when it hit me like a ton of bricks, I was like, not ready for it. And interestingly, later that same day, so I made it into the final, just barely. Later that same day, I came back and I went significantly faster, like close to my personal record. And it didn't, I wouldn't even say it didn't hurt as much. You know, it probably hurt as much, but I was prepared. Yeah, it's generally better to tell yourself like, this is really going to hurt, but not in a bad way, because when you go into it with fear, saying, I don't know if I can do this, that's, you know, that can hold you back. What I've learned to do is to go into it with almost a curiosity. Like, this is really going to hurt. I wonder how that's going to feel. You know, like, let's just like really get into it. Like, really just enjoy this learning experience of like, just how hard this can hurt. And that works a lot better. And you mentioned,
Go ahead.
Oh, you mentioned, you know, going through that post-Olympic Games slump. What was really helpful was, like we were talking about, knowing it was coming, but also knowing that I'm not alone. I think a lot of people, because we all have this idea, you reach your goal, everything's great, you know, you ride off into the sunset and you're happy. And if you don't know that, and you, no one ever, you don't talk to people and, you know, have them say, yeah, me too, you might think that you're the only one that feels that way. And that isolation is crushing.
Very much. Because you feel like you're the only person in the world and nobody can relate to you. So you have nobody to talk to. One of the things I wanted to ask you real quick along that was the curiosity aspect. How did you notice over your, maybe just focusing on your Olympic career, your self-talk during competition change? Did it change over the course, or did you kind of have a game plan coming in and just make little tweaks with how you talk to yourself in those moments of discomfort and competitiveness?
I've been lucky in that a lot of my motivation allowed me from the start to have good self-talk. I started rowing, got good at rowing just because I thought it was so fun. I loved being around other people, teammates who were good at it, who I could hang out with. I loved being on the water. Gotta be honest, I actually didn't love competing. but I loved showing that I could do it. And that's great when you can do it. But when you don't do it, well, that can be really hard. So most of the time, because I was improving so fast, I was like, yeah, this is fun. Like, I'm doing this, whatever. And what eventually started to happen is when you first start something, you improve very quickly and then you hit a plateau, and then you might even go down a little bit before you know, rise over the next mountain. And that was one of the things one of my first coaches in high school taught me, was how to deal with it when you have these slumps, because I would get really down on myself and, beat myself up mentally when I hit them and I wasn't doing as well as I thought I should. But she taught me, you have to have self-compassion, because you're not going to have your best performance every day. And a sports psychologist put it really succinctly years later, when I was going through some tough times, he said, don't aim to have your best performance every day. Just aim to beat your average, because you will consistently improve.
I love that.
And now this brings me to what I want to give you a hard time over.
Oh, let's do it. Let's do it.
So some of your, like, you've got these t-shirts that say like, compete every day. And there's one of them. Compete at all costs. And
the at all cost ones. Yeah. Okay. I'm with you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I looked at that and I was like, I think I know what you're getting at, but I worry that it's sending the wrong message, because
I love it.
Because it's like, well, first of all, competing against other people, One of the biggest changes I made in 2020 that I think really helped me was, instead of thinking like, oh, I want to beat this woman who, you know, I got in to, so we would do these ERG tests, these rowing machine fitness tests all together, yeah. Like 30 people in a big room. And I would walk in there and I'd look around and I'd be like, I love everyone in here. They're all my teammates. I want them all to do amazing. And I hope they feel the same way about me. And like, this is just going to like big love fest. It's going to be so great. And I did so much better than I used to do. And I was like, oh, I want to kill this person. So competing against other people, like I think of it more as like collaborating. Like we are here together to push ourselves to our limits. And then you could say, well, compete against yourself. That's one of the things I love about the rowing machine is you're really only competing against yourself, because you can look at the numbers and they're so soul crushingly obvious, objective. That's the word, is so soul crushingly objective. But yeah, the competing for me is important only so much as I know what my average, what I'm capable of, and I want to do a little better. I don't want to like beat my best every day.
Okay. So a couple of things on this, and I love this conversation. Okay. So the first, I'm 100% with you on the teammates, because I also believe when we have teammates with us, they push us to a level outside of our comfort zone, especially those that are better than us, because mm-hmm. it forces us to raise our game at a point that we may not get to that level of discomfort or effort without someone there pushing us. However, when we understand the only competition and our most important is with ourselves, our identity is not tied up in how well we did against them, but how well did we do ourselves? Did we give our best efforts, and can we take pride in that? Mm-hmm. So that's where I see those two. I think all of us individually need teammates, personally, professionally, to get us to a level we can't get to on our own. And I say that as an ultra competitive person, but we can't let our identity and worth be tied up in that. So to your point of like, when you come home, like the self-love, the at all cost shirt she's mentioning on the back, it says at all costs, really big, compete every day. But underneath it, it says every goal takes a certain amount of sacrifice and every goal has its price. There are no discounts, no shortcuts. There's only the hard way and hard work. At the end of the day, no one's coming to do it for you. No one is watching and making sure you're on track. It's all on you. So the idea of the at all costs is like, you're going to have to make sacrifices. Nobody's going to come pay the price for you. If you want it, it's all on you to go do it. So to both of those points, that was kind of where that mentality, because to your point, you made sacrifices to pursue this career. Like greatness at any level requires sacrifice, right? You sacrifice social time, some relational time, probably some opportunities because you had to be on the rower. You sacrifice sleep, we know of, comfort for sure. So like there's all of those that go into it. And one of the things you said there that I really loved is you came in with this idea of like, I love all my teammates. I'm going to perform free, right? Because gratitude, we perform better with a gratitude mindset than a fear-based mindset. Oh my God, I can't lose to these people versus I love everybody here. I want to do my best. I heard you talk about at one point in your Olympic career, you just decided you were going to have a protege. You were going to pour into someone on your team. You just picked this teammate out and you're like, I'm going to pour into them whether they like it or not. What I'm curious about is, how have you been able to do that professionally? And the reason I say this is because here's where my brain went. We've all been burned by group projects. If you are a high performer, you have been in a class project in middle school, high school, college, maybe law school, to where you did all the work because you didn't trust the other people to do the work at the same level, or they weren't going to. In Olympic pursuits, like everybody's pursuing being on the team and making gold. Like there's a different level of accountability into it. In our professional lives, that's not always the case. Every organization we know has those people. So you having a practice and then going through law school and everything, how did you handle working with people who weren't as driven as you for a level of excellence? And did it drive you crazy?
I want to park that question. Do you want to come back to it?
Okay, that's fine.
Because there's something you said just before you asked that question that I was like, that I think is exactly what I needed to understand about your merch, and I hope everyone else understands about your message. You said, compete from a place of gratitude, not of fear. And that's like, you've put it just, yeah, perfect. Because the fear, that's what I worry about when it's like, compete at all costs. It's like, I have to win at all costs. And because immediately that creates a tension of like, what happens if I don't? That's where the fear comes in. And then you hold yourself back. You're not going to do as well as you can. And
I think that's the difference between compete at all costs and win at all costs.
Good point. Okay. All right.
Compete's in your control, right? How you compete is 100% in your control. Whether you win or not is not.
Okay. Perfect. Yes. I'm remembering sitting on the start line in London, and there was a lot of pressure on us. This is my third Olympic Games. We'd already won gold in Beijing. We were defending our gold. So we were favorites, a lot of pressure. And I looked around, and there was like Canada on our left and Romania on our right. I'm making that up. I can't actually remember who was on each side. But I would look at them and smile and nod each side and just be like, I didn't actually say it, but I thought to myself, hey guys, like, good to see you. Thanks for being here. Because if they weren't there, we'd just be rowing that thing alone and no one would care. You know, there wouldn't be millions of people watching on TV. I wouldn't go nearly as fast as I'm about to go. And that feeling of like, hey, thanks for coming and collaborating with me on this great adventure. That feeling of gratitude is just incompatible with fear. Gratitude is incompatible with fear and nervousness. So that was how I managed to have a great race that day.
I would also say you probably struck fear in the hearts of your competitors, because if you're defending gold and you're the one that's like winning and you look over and they're relaxed and smiling, you're thinking, yeah, oh my God.
Yeah. It's a really good competitive tactic to just be like relaxed and happy. Anyway, so I want to get to the question that, how do you deal with working with people, especially when your success depends on their effort?
Yeah.
When they might not be as invested as you are.
I mean, we always heard the phrase, Kobe Bryant was like, I don't pass teammates the ball when I've seen their work ethic. I'm like, yeah, he's a ball hawk. He's like, no, I'm just, they don't work that hard. I don't trust them.
Yeah.
And so I think about that. And obviously that's an extreme case, but I think about it because rowing, everybody's relying on each other. There's a level of commitment when you're pursuing an Olympic career that when you're pursuing a professional career, isn't always the case. Even in a field like law, where you have a bunch of type A's and high achievers, it's still not always the case. And so I'm curious, in your professional world, how you've dealt with that, and then where you've selected, like, I'm making you my, like, I'm mentoring you, whether you like it or not.
So I've dealt with it more in my volunteer activities. So there's like a hierarchy of like, how much people are into it. Like when you're on the Olympic team, everybody's really working hard at a job. Like probably most people are pretty motivated. That's their job. But when you get to volunteers, like it's questionable how motivated people are. Some people are, you know, they're not getting paid. So I guess they have to have some motivation for being there other than getting paid. But, you know, generally if something's going to go by the wayside, like that's going to be the first thing. And I found, I would just try to like fill in the gaps, work myself harder. And I got really burned out. Like just was, I'm president of alumni of an alumni association, got really burned out, was ready to quit, had to learn a lot of hard lessons. One of the main lessons I learned was it doesn't work to just work harder yourself, because then what happens is people around you are like, oh, she's got it. She wants to do this. And so they just let you do it. Right? Like, all right, cool. You want to take this? Great. You know? And you're just martyring yourself. Like it's not productive. So sometimes you actually have to accept that things might not get done. And it's more of a learning experience, and it's better for the team if you just let things fail. Look, it's not the generally not the end of the world. I'm glad I'm not a doctor or something. Like, people don't die.
Yeah, that's right.
When shit doesn't get done. And then, well, okay, but then how, once that has happened, once we've all like learned the lesson, like, all right, this didn't work, then how do you come back from there? I found some, especially as a leader, like everyone's on your team is good at something. And as a leader, you need to figure out what people are good at and bring that out of them. If they're good at it, they're probably going to want to do it. Like, it makes you feel good to do the things you're good at. So figure out what each person is good at and draw that out, like give them that task. And then in the, like the mentoring side, hopefully you're good at that too. Right. So you can be like, here's how I did it. The most fun that I had mentoring a teammate, interestingly, actually, she was good at something that I wasn't good at, now that I think about it. In 2011, there was a new kid on the team, and she was very strong, but she'd only been rowing for a year. She came from swimming, and so she got on the rowing machine and just crushed everybody. She could beat me on the rowing machine, but yeah, she was very, very novice in the boat. And so the coach, the Olympic team coach, pulled me aside. And so I'm known for being like very technically proficient in a boat, pulled me aside and was like, all right, I want you to teach Kara to row. I'm going to put you guys in a pair, a two person boat. And I want you to teach her to row. And this was terrifying for me because about every 10 strokes, I felt like we were going to flip. Like it was that bad. But when I think about it, like I learned as much from her as she learned from me because we were good at different things. Like I was like central operations. I was like making sure the boat was set and we were doing it at the right stroke rate and I was steering and I was doing all these different things. And I was like, your job is just to pull hard. I figured out what she was good at and, you know, like, and she knew that she was supposed to be looking at me to figure out the technique. So somehow we like kind of came together and it was real rough, but, we had a real bond that summer that we rode together. She ended up making the Olympic team and winning a bronze medal a year later.
Love it. Well, and to your point, like the beginning is always clunky. And if we expect it to be smooth and simple from the get-go, like you're going to be disappointed. Where if we go back to what we talked about of expecting discomfort, you expect to have growing pains and having to work through this process, you approach it a little bit differently. And I think that's just a really good reminder of how you set that up. And then she went on to have great success and you got to have an impact on that, which is really cool. I want to close up a little bit because I know this episode's airing in May. We're recording early April. But you're about to go to Switzerland for an incredible honor, the Thomas Keller Medal, right? Which is the lifetime achievement for rowing. And you're the first American to get it. So talk to me about what this means for you. And then what you just hope, like afterwards, the impact maybe has on American rowing or even women in rowing, what you hope to, I would say, leave as part of your Olympic legacy.
Yeah. The really cool thing about this award is it has. So if you look at the criteria, like there are five criteria. The first three criteria are basically about your competitive history. But the last two are about how you are seen and how you move in the community. You have to have a legendary status. And you have to have be a good sportswoman who has given back to the rowing community. And for me, that is what I'm most proud of. Like working hard and winning Olympic gold medals, I'm definitely proud of that. But that doesn't speak to my character. It just speaks to my work ethic. Whereas the last two speak more to my character because I've spent a lot of time in the last really, gosh, I guess the last Olympic gold medal I won was 12 years ago. So I've spent the last 12 years really working hard on being a leader, being a good citizen and a part of the community. And one of the thing I always loved about rowing, it was why when I was 12 years old, why I just got like so into it is I felt like I belonged. I felt like these were my people and this was a community I really cared about. So winning the Thomas Keller medal is kind of like a tangible embodiment of the thing that has been so important to me pretty much my whole life.
I love that. And I contrast that having heard an interview where you shared your first experience was this big burly man coming up to you in the grocery store, being like, you rowing. And you were like 12.
You're like, yeah, what? I was terrified. I was like, what are you talking about? You're scary. but I was 6 foot tall at 12 years old and I was very awkward. And I was in search of friends. And that's what I found when I started rowing. So that's why I kept doing it.
Well, congratulations. That's so incredible. And I just love your perspective on that of it's not about the results you created in the water, but more of the lives touched in the community. And I think that's just a powerful thing. And as we talked about kind of off air, I threw out like, hey, how has the movie Boys in the Boat impacted the community? And you mentioned the book had a great impact, but I would imagine your work is having probably as much, if not bigger, just in a lot of those individual lives, especially the success you've had and now being the first American to win this award. So congrats to you. As we wrap up today, for anybody that would love to learn a little bit more, heck, maybe somebody is in the Boston area and needs a legal team. Where's the best place to connect with you? I imagine would it be LinkedIn? And then where can we learn more about your practice and the work you're doing today?
Yeah. LinkedIn would be number one. It's Karin Davies. And then my law practice is Podium Law. And the website is podiumlaw.com. Podium, of course, being a reference to the Olympic podium.
I was about to say, where did that name come from? Absolutely love it. Karin, thank you so much for coming on the show this week. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. And thanks for setting me straight about what it means to compete every day.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Compete Everyday podcast. To get in touch with the team, drop us an email to podcast@competeeveryday.com. And to find out more about our resources, content, and gear that will help you build that winning mindset so you better compete for your best life, visit competeeveryday.com.